eKatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Nick.
Today we are tackling, well, a truly monumental text. It sits right at the foundation of so much Western thought, law, and morality. We're talking about the Torah.
Indeed. It's also known as the Pentateuch, or, you know, simply the five books of Moses. And our sources really frame this not just as a religious text in isolation,
right,
but more like humanity's first go at a really comprehensive blueprint for society. It's where the divine realm and the mortal realm sort of meet, and they try to figure out how to, well, how to coexist.
A blueprint. I like that framing. Because it really is trying to answer those huge philosophical questions, isn't it? Mm. Like, what defines us? What does a just society actually look like? What is righteousness, really?
Exactly. So our mission today for you listening is to try and distill that blueprint, to understand the framework it offers for creating a society grounded in spiritual awareness and ethical conduct.
And how that vision, that goal, still challenges us, still guides us, even thousands of years later.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's unpack this blueprint. Where do we start? Maybe with the architect. Who traditionally gets the credit?
Right. Well, traditionally, the text is attributed, you know, pretty much entirely to Moses.
Moses.
Yes. The belief is quite absolute. He received the divine revelation directly, straight from God at Mount Sinai. He was seen as the unparalleled conduit.
The direct line.
That's what gives the text its sacred authority, that sense of divine origin.
Okay, but then here's where it gets really interesting, right? The academic perspective throws a bit of a spanner in the works there.
Oh, it complicates that singular view immensely, yeah. Modern scholarship, especially through something called the documentary hypothesis.
Yes, I've heard of that.
It suggests the Torah is more like the product of various authors, different voices, compiled, edited, you know, over a really long time. We're talking centuries.
Centuries, wow. So roughly, what, like 950 BCE down to maybe 550 BCE?
Yeah.
That sort of span?
Exactly that time frame, yeah. It wasn't a single event, but a process. The hypothesis identifies four main literary strands or voices, often known by letters.
Yeah,
that's them. J, the Yahwist, E, the Elohist, D, the Deuteronomist, and P, the priestly source. And they're essentially different schools of thought, each with its own emphasis, its own focus.
So, for example, J might describe God in very human terms, like walking in the garden.
Right, very anthropomorphic.
Well, E sees God as more distant, communicating through dreams or angels. How did they mesh those different views together? That sounds like it would create some, well, tension.
Well, that tension is arguably part of the genius of the text. It's not a monologue. It's more like a rich, layered conversation happening across centuries.
Mm.
The authors, the editors, they were acting as collective preservers, interpreters, translating ancient experiences into, let's say, accessible wisdom. They weren't necessarily aiming for simple historical consistency in the way we think of it now.
More like thematic richness.
Yeah.
Layering perspectives.
Exactly. To create something comprehensive, adaptable, that layering explains why it is such a mix. You've got narrative, law, moral philosophy, spiritual guidance, all woven together.
Okay, so its core purpose then. It's kind of twofold. Telling the origin story, but also laying down the law.
That sums it up well. It narrates the origins of, first, the world, and then specifically the people of Israel, and then it articulates the covenant laws, the rules of that divine-human relationship.
And the story itself, the narrative arc, it starts huge, doesn't it? Universal scale.
Absolutely. Creation, Adam and Eve, Noah, the Tower of Babel, these stories are wrestling with universal human concerns. Order versus chaos, sin, moral failure, things relevant to everyone.
And then it zooms in. Quite dramatic.
It does. It becomes very particular. The focus shifts to the calling of Abraham, then Isaac, Jacob, from all humanity down to this one family promised to become a nation.
And that leads to the big national moment, the defining story, the Exodus.
The ultimate liberation narrative, freedom from slavery in Egypt, which then leads directly to the revelation of the law at Mount Sinai. That's where the covenant, this divine human partnership, gets formalized.
Right. And the whole thing wraps up after, what, 40 years wandering in the wilderness?
40 tough years, yes. And it ends with Moses giving these final powerful speeches, preparing the next generation, the ones born free, to actually live by these rules in the promised land.
So the Torah is really aiming to be a complete guide for human flourishing, integrating the spiritual, with the practical, the governmental.
That's the vision. It's a story of a difficult journey from slavery to freedom, from bondage to responsibility, all under this principle of divine human partnership.
Okay, let's dive into the five books themselves now, starting at the start.
Yep.
Genesis.
Right. In the beginning, Genesis really lays the theological and moral groundwork. It establishes human dignity right away in the image of God.
That's huge.
It's the bedrock for universal human worth. And then immediately you get moral responsibility, free will with Adam and Eve, consequences with Cain and Abel, the flood.
Those patriarchal stories, though, they show incredible faith, but also, frankly, incredible failures.
Oh, absolutely. They're very human. The Joseph story is particularly powerful, wouldn't you say, as pure narrative?
It's stunning. Betrayed by his brothers, sold into slavery.
And he rises to power, but uses it for forgiveness, not revenge, to save the very family that wronged him. It's this incredible demonstration of providence, maybe? Turning intended evil into ultimate good. Redemption is possible. That's a massive theme running through it.
Okay, so from family drama to national drama. Yeah. Next is Exodus, Shemo. Names, a big liberation story.
This is the paradigm, really. For resistance, for freedom, you have the 10 plagues, Passover being established, crossing the Red Sea. It's epic stuff.
But the core is Sinai, right? The 10 commandments?
The ethical core, yes. And then the creation of this whole legal framework around it. Building a functioning moral society from the ground up.
But then, boom, the golden calf, right after the big revelation. They make the covenant and almost immediately break it. Doesn't that seem, I don't know, a bit harsh, expecting so much from newly freed slaves?
It highlights that critical tension, doesn't it, between the spiritual ideal and the, well, the pull of the material, the tangible. What's fascinating is Moses' reaction, his passionate advocacy, arguing with God.
He really goes to bat for them.
He does, and it sets this pattern, prophetic leadership, intercession, covenant renewal. It suggests failure is maybe part of the process, but the key is that commitment to return to Teshuvah.
Okay, so after this structure is set in Exodus, we get Leviticus, Vayikra, and He Called. This one often feels like the tough one, right? Lots of ritual, sacrifice.
It can seem that way. It is the legal heart focusing on the details, but the central idea, the organizing principle, is holiness. Kedusha.
Holiness. What does that mean in this context?
Well, the revolutionary part here is that Leviticus insists holiness isn't just about ritual purity or sacrifices. It's deeply ethical. The section called the Holiness Code explicitly links religious observance to social justice.
Ah, so it's saying your temple rituals don't mean much if you're cheating people in the marketplace.
Precisely. True holiness demands that your everyday life, your social interactions, your business dealings reflect those divine values. It connects the sacred and the secular.
And Leviticus also has those really radical economic ideas, the sabbatical year, the jubilee year.
Yes. Mandated debt forgiveness, letting the land lie fallow, restoring property to original families.
That sounds like it would completely upend any system of permanent wealth concentration.
It's designed to. It fundamentally challenges the usual ancient Near Eastern power structures where wealth just accumulated at the top, generation after generation. The Jubilee is like this built-in economic reset button, ensuring a degree of equity, making sure the system serves people, not just capital accumulation.
Wow. Okay, after those rules, we hit the road again in Numbers. Bamidbar, in the wilderness. This chronicles that long, difficult 40-year journey.
Right. This book is really about organization, transition, and frankly, a lot of failure. You see the censuses, arranging the tribes, trying to turn former slaves into an organized nation.
But mostly you hear about the complaining, the rebellion.
A lot of resistance to responsibility, yeah. Deep mistrust. The story of the spies is key here.
They go into the promised land, come back terrified, and convince everyone it's impossible.
Exactly. And that lack of faith, that fear, leads to this devastating consequence. That entire generation, the ones who came out of Egypt, won't enter the land. They'll die in the wilderness.
That's harsh. But it underlines the idea that freedom requires a whole new mindset, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can't bring the slave mentality into the land of responsibility.
It's about that transformation. The book explores leadership struggles too, Korah's rebellion. Even Moses makes mistakes. It shows just how hard it is to forge a truly unified, responsible community out of people marked by trauma and oppression. The desert was a crucible.
And finally, we arrive at Deuteronomy, Devarim, words. This is Moses' big farewell, right?
It is. It's structured as these profound final speeches. Moses looks back, reviews the history, reinterprets the law for the new generation about to enter the land.
And there's a strong emphasis on the covenant. on the consequences of sticking to it or breaking it.
Huge emphasis. The blessings and the curses. Obedience brings flourishing. Disobedience brings disaster. It's very direct.
And this book seems to really double down on social justice, protecting the vulnerable.
Absolutely. Over and over, it hammers home the responsibility to care for the widow, the orphan, the stranger, the poor, explicitly linking it back to their own experience. Remember, you were strangers, slaves, in Egypt.
Don't forget where you came from.
Exactly. And then, poignantly, it ends with Moses' death. He sees the promised land from afar, but doesn't go in himself.
Why is that significant?
It ensures the focus remains on the message, the law, the covenant itself, not on the personality of the leader. The legacy is the teaching, not the teacher.
That's a powerful way to end it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've walked through the five books. If we zoom out, what are the really big core ideas, the key messages that resonate beyond the specific stories?
Well, perhaps the most revolutionary idea is this concept of divine-human partnership. The Torah basically says humans are co-creators with God in perfecting the world.
Co-creators. That's a big claim for humanity.
It elevates human dignity incredibly. It gives us immense moral responsibility. God makes promises, sets goals, but achieving them requires active human cooperation, human effort.
And flowing directly from that, you get the focus on justice and righteousness.
Tzedek.
Yes. Justice isn't just a good idea for society. It's presented as a divine attribute that we must emulate. It's the moral foundation specifically designed to protect the most vulnerable. It has to be actively pursued. Right. Then we circle back to holiness, Kedusha.
Which, as we said, isn't just about ritual. It's about dedicating life, all of life, to a higher purpose. It collapses that distinction between sacred and secular. True holiness demands ethical behavior in your everyday dealings.
In the nitty-gritty.
Exactly. And finally, maybe the glue holding it all together. Memory and transmission. Zikaron.
Remembering the past.
Critically important. The community sustains itself through shared memory, especially remembering the Exodus, the liberation. That story, that wisdom, has to be actively taught, passed down generation to generation.
So it shapes how you act now.
If you forget your history, particularly the history of oppression and liberation, you lose your ethical compass.
It's often called the bedrock of Western ethics, and you can see why. There are so many memorable lines.
Absolutely. Lines that have shaped law, philosophy, morality for millennia.
Like right back in Genesis 1:26.
Yeah.
Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness.
That's the cornerstone, isn't it? The theological basis for inherent universal human dignity and worth. Everyone matters because everyone reflects the divine.
And then that demanding line from Deuteronomy 16:20. Justice, justice you shall pursue.
That repetition is powerful. It's not justice you should hope for or wait for. It's active, continuous. It requires constant effort, constant vigilance from individuals and the community. You have to chase it.
And maybe the most famous ethical command from Leviticus 19:18 in the Holiness Code, you shall love your neighbor as yourself.
The golden rule, essentially. It makes empathy, reciprocity, the absolute foundation of ethics. It gives you a principle that guides you even when specific laws don't cover a situation. How would you want to be treated?
And connecting history directly to ethics, that constant refrain, especially in Deuteronomy, remember that you were slaves in Egypt.
That's history transformed into a moral imperative. Because you knew the bitterness of oppression, you were forbidden from becoming an oppressor. It fuels the obligation to care for the stranger, the refugee, the outsider. Your experience must teach you compassion.
So bringing it all home, how can we, you know, apply these ancient ideas today? What's the practical takeaway for modern life?
Well, the concept of teshuvah return or repentance is incredibly relevant. It's not just about saying sorry.
It's more structured.
Much more. It involves genuinely acknowledging the harm you've caused, making restitution where possible, actually fixing the damage, and then making a concrete commitment to change your behavior going forward. It's about taking real responsibility that applies personally, professionally, even nationally.
And what about those economic ethics? Fair wages, honest dealings, the Jubilee's idea of preventing permanent poverty.
They offer a powerful critique of purely profit-driven systems. They provide a framework for thinking about corporate social responsibility, sustainable practices, economic justice. The idea that the economy should serve human flourishing, not the other way around, feels very timely.
And the rule of law idea, distributed leadership.
Yeah, the model isn't a monarchy initially. You have judges, elders, prophets, different centers of authority. It implicitly supports checks and balances, accountability, preventing power from concentrating too much in one place. That's a lesson modern governance constantly relearns.
And maybe the most directly applicable for many of us, the weekly day of rest, Shabbat.
Huh, yes. In our always-on 24/7 culture, it's a radical idea, a mandated time to just stop. Disconnect from work, from commerce, from endless productivity. Focus on rest, family, community, spiritual refreshment. It's an ancient solution to modern burnout.
A built-in pause button for civilization.
Pretty much.
So, final thoughts. What's the biggest takeaway for you from this deep dive into the Torah's blueprint?
For me, it's that profound integration, the refusal to separate spiritual life from social responsibility. It lays out this incredibly ambitious, sometimes challenging, but ultimately hopeful vision for society. One built not on power or wealth, but on justice, compassion, memory, and a shared sense of purpose between the human and the divine.
What struck me, actually, was the complexity of how it came together. The idea of those different sources, J, E, D, P, being woven together over centuries by editors. It's mind-boggling. Yet they created something with such a coherent, powerful vision that it shaped billions of lives. That multi-layered authorship, creating enduring wisdom. That surprised me.
It is remarkable. The idea that the universe operates on moral law, and that we're not just subjects but active partners in making it just, that's a powerful, demanding legacy. Justice. Justice you shall pursue. It's still the assignment.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.